Welcome. I am Andrea Gold, and I'm your host tonight in our second podcast in our series on clinical practice and applications for therapists. Tonight, our speaker is Jen Eden, and we're going to be doing a different kind of format. This is an interview question and answer session, so we will not have any slides to follow along. So I am absolutely delighted to introduce our speaker, Jennifer Eden, who is the Director of DBT Training and Consultation for the Bridge Training Institute in Massachusetts. She's also the owner of her private practice, Dialectical and Cognitive Behavior Therapy. Jen holds a Master of Science degree in Clinical Psychology, and she was intensively trained in Dialectical Behavior Therapy, DBT, by Dr. Charles Swenson and the late Cindy Sanderson. And she completed an advanced intensive training by Dr. Marsha Linehan, who's the developer of DBT. She is certified in DBT by the Linehan Board of Certification, and she has extensive experience providing DBT treatment, training, consultation, and supervision to clinicians and interns. Jen trains and consults across the country at various agencies, and this includes lots of different levels of care, outpatient, residential, hospital, and state-level departments. And she's also worked with many public schools and college universities in training and consulting on implementing DBT and mindfulness within schools. So she's really got a unique perspective working with teenagers and adults in different settings. And previously at The Bridge, she provided training, consultation, and supervision to the DBT programs, including those that serve adolescents, young adults, mentally ill adults, adult women with physical disabilities and traumatic brain injuries, and adults with developmental disabilities. I want to add on a personal note that she is a dynamic, energetic, and passionate person, and a true pleasure to interact with. She's a type of person who really exemplifies the way that DBT is an all-in life philosophy. With her extensive experience doing DBT with teens and adults in all these different settings and levels of care, she's really going to give us a unique perspective on our topic tonight, which is using dialectical behavior therapy, or DBT, to treat teens and adults diagnosed with BPD. And the question we're going to highlight throughout her talk is what's different and what's not. So welcome, Jen.
Thank you. That now was so complimentary. I really appreciate your kind words. I just want to say that my answers are really mine, that I have no doubt clinicians will listen to this and have a, you know, might have different responses, which is okay because we are all dialectical. So you pretty much covered all the different things I've done. In all, I don't stay bored. I love all the different people I work with, and of course I love DBT, so.
Wonderful. Well, let's start off, Jen, by you giving us kind of a quick intro to our topic.
A quick intro. So with teenagers versus adults, there's so many differences, and there's pros and cons to both. I know those who work with teenagers don't want to work with adults, which is hysterical because they have, like, parents. And then I know those who work with adults don't want to work with teenagers, and of course part of it is the complexity of that, and of course maybe they forgot what it's like to be a teenager. What's good about me is I'm really good at channeling my teenage years, so I think that, you know, can be really helpful. And then of course the parents think I know what I'm talking about, so balancing that is really helpful. How's that for introduction?
It's great. And tell us, who did you start with? Did you start with teens or did you start with adults? How did you get started with DBT?
Yep, so I started originally in residential. Before I even knew what DBT was, I actually worked inpatient in adult psychiatric ward where, ironically, this was before DBT, I think, really was well known, or I don't know, I didn't know it. I was in graduate school. And
so what year are we talking?
Really?
Ish.
1997. Okay. Wait, let me think. Yep, 1997. And what was neat about my pre-DBT days was I found out that if you are an adult woman getting involuntary committed to psychiatric unit, you automatically got a BPD diagnosis. And as a grad student, of course, being like, you know, the person who doesn't really know what I'm talking about as a line worker, was thinking, geez, if I got placed against my will, I would have gotten diagnosed because I would have kicked the door and thrown the biggest fit ever to try to get out. So it's interesting how quickly that label can get thrown around. But I started with, so that's a side note, but as a clinician, I started originally in residential with adolescents, some young adults. Most of them were pretty significantly impaired. Then expanded my experiences with young adults from more of a DMH setting, a Department of Mental Health setting, and then adults all in residential, which expanded to supportive housing based on the kind of contracts the Bridge got. And then now I, you know, all my clinical work outside consultation is in private practice, and I treat adolescents. I have a lot of young adults since Worcester has tons of colleges. And adults. I have some, you know, adults who are out of school, have full-time jobs, and so forth.
So let's jump in and talk. Let's start with what EPD looks like. And it sounds like you have lots of experience over the years and currently working with both developmental phases, the teens, young adults, and older adults. So First question for you is, how would you say the diagnosis presentation of BPD looks different in teens versus adults? And in what way is it similar?
Yeah, so obviously the diagnostic criteria is the same. I'm not going to list them out. You told me I have to be dynamic and energetic, so I'm not going to read anything. teenagers, what's interesting is a lot of times the adults that come through my practice and those I've worked with outside my practice in various settings, they've had a lot of behaviors for a long time. So if they have substance abuse and addiction, they might have, you know, say, for example, been an alcoholic or a heroin addict for a decade or two decades. So their habits they use to manage their emotions are, they're pretty instilled habits. They've been doing it a long time. Just, you know, stopping it just seems foreign to them. With teenagers, I find that obviously they're younger, so a lot of them had just started playing around with substances or learned how to self-harm in the first hospitalization or by their friends in, you know, the school locker room or something, the bathroom. And then they were like, oh, wow, this works for me. So a lot of them who come to me have only been self-harming for 6 months, 9 months, and their parents recently found out. They might have behaviors that their parents don't know about. But a lot of it with the teenagers, it's more of how they manage emotions and their habits are not. I feel like they can respond to treatment more quickly, if they're interested, because their behaviors haven't been going on as long. If that makes sense.
Yes.
The hard part with teenagers is so much of their presentation naturally has looks like BPD. Teenagers are black and white thinkers. Teenagers act out. They're impulsive. Their emotions are all over the place. They're hormonal. I remember when I was an adolescent, I was highly hormonal, and some of my emotional behaviors, I didn't even know why I was doing it, but I knew I was acting weird or out of control.
So then how do you, if it's looking so similar, how do you tease out when it's typical adolescence and when it's something that's like BPD and requiring treatment?
Great question. And I think that's tricky. And I think a lot of people come in with judgments, like parents getting a recommendation or parents, how they view their kid, pending their own values. If their kid smokes pot once, oh my gosh, they're a drug addict. So for a clinician, they have to navigate all these different adult reports and think, okay, is that normal teenage behavior or is that moving into a different place? Why is the person doing that behavior? So for example, experimenting with alcohol. Most adults might say they might have, some might not, some didn't, but most did in some way, and that's normal behavior. your teenager who drinks every night or smokes, now it's smoking pot, or marijuana or weed, whatever the cool thing or appropriate thing to say.
Vaping, juuling.
Oh, my gosh, you know more. I know vaping now, the juuling, I've heard that recently. I got a nice seminar on that from a school once, actually, during lunch when I was doing a training. So, yes, all those things are like, what's the big deal? Everyone does it. And I think with the culture change of how we view marijuana, Massachusetts laws are changing that. It's like, well, what's the problem? It's legal. So there's this piece of like, so is that pathological or is that just being a teenager? And that's interesting to tease out. Usually you have to look at what's the function of the behavior. Why is it happening? You know, being mindful, you know, okay, you have a lot of breakups, you go out with people, you break up, like all that's normal teenage stuff. And then it's like, well, what's going on behind it? Why, you know, what's the relationship all about? Why are they breaking up? Why are they going back out? Why do their friends, quote unquote, fire them all the time, as parents might describe it? And I really think details matter. Finding out what's kids freaking out about normal stuff, like, oh, my gosh, I won't get into college now because I got a C. Is that over emotional response or is that, well, I think that's the way teenagers respond. So how do you differentiate that? Whereas adults, you know, I think they're more, there's a maturity there a little bit more that they might not be having an over response to, say, for example, an A versus an B, or, you know, if they got a failing grade or what that means. So, so I don't know if that hits it, but.
Yeah. And one thing you mentioned was that because the patterns of behaviors that bring people into treatment may look like decades for adults, but maybe more like months or even a year or two in teens, sometimes that can be a pro or an advantage in treatment that it could maybe facilitate change. I wonder if that's also a double-edged sword where there are disadvantages. So if somebody has been struggling for decades, I wonder if there's whatever's bringing them into treatment then leads to increased motivation that may actually promote treatment. So are there, I guess what I'm asking is, for this distinction of how long-standing the problems are, do you see anything that make it more difficult in teens?
In teenagers? Okay. Well, certainly they might not want to change. Their parents want them to change. So that's very different. If an adult walks in, they're ready, they want it, and of course they're ambivalent, but they chose to show up. I don't work in a prison or anything. So with teenagers, I've actually had one recently fill out an assessment, and she was, like, too normal. Like, I'm like, I'm sorry. No teenager would get a zero on that scale. You would have some presentation of some kind just by being a teenager. So sometimes they do whatever they can to not be in treatment if they're not interested, which means they deny everything. And that could be a challenge because how do you get to work helping them if the door's closed?
Right. And I imagine in our audience, we have clinicians who have had teenagers show up that say, I'm only here because my parents are making me and they don't want to be there. And I imagine we have family members where this is true too. So do you have any tips, Jen, for approaching DBT treatment when teens are saying they're forced to be there?
I would certainly validate that they are forced. So I say, yeah, you know what? I'm glad you don't want to be here. And I use a lot of irreverence, which is, you know, sometimes humor, sometimes saying something off-putting or challenging, which out of context doesn't sound professional, but within the conversation is. So I'd say, well, if this was the highlight of your week, we'd have a new problem, which is how do you act like a teenager and be a teenager versus hanging out with a therapist? So I might be that, like, off-putting because they're not expecting that. They'd be expecting saying, I know you don't want to be here, honey, blah, blah, blah. I don't talk like that. So my goal is to be not the therapist they may have ever expected. which is fun because then I don't have to do anything really I learn in graduate school. So I would say, well, yeah, sucks to be here. What are we going to do
Excellent.
With our hour or something like that?
That's really helpful. So switching gears a bit, we talked about how changes in relationships, experimentation, and emotions and changes in emotions is part of typical development. But that when it looks like it's a problem and there is this extreme level of emotion dysregulation, often we engage people in treatment. So I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about the theory of how emotion dysregulation develops in DBT, the biosocial theory. If maybe you could define that or talk about that a little bit for our audience and how you might explain this theory the way you would to an adult patient that you're treating, somebody who's been diagnosed with BPD.
Absolutely. Usually adults come in either knowing they have BPD or knowing they have elements of it. They've researched it sometimes, or they've come in and said, someone told me to do this, but I read about it. I don't have BPD. So they come in different ways, but they already come in with some education, at least in my experience. And what's nice about doing the biosocial theory with adults is you're only talking to them. So the biology is emotional sensitivity, having intense emotions. A lot of times when I talk to adults, I say all of us have this sometimes, and I might give examples from my own life, how I'm more likely to cry at a movie than my husband or something like that. And then I talk about the invalidating environment of how, sometimes someone might feel, just isolated, not understood by other people. Sometimes they feel, just different, when you have your mom and dad or best friend or partner say, I really have no idea why the hell you're acting like this right now, or what's your problem, or, my gosh, you have to overreact to everything. It's interesting to see their example or their reaction, but they're also really able to say, oh, that was my dad all the time. And then they could just openly and freely talk about how their parents, what their parents did, how their friends, called them names and said they were, being dramatic or things like that. And so I think there's a free conversation that goes back and forth. While also I'm saying, invalidation is nothing more than, feeling misunderstood. So I really try to, that's your like kind of 30-second blurb of biosocial theory. So, so I emphasize that because it's like not your dad is not this hard person, unless of course they abuse you, but they just didn't get it. And
right,
usually adults cry because they're like, yes, oh my God, they didn't get it. I'm alone, that kind of thing. So,
yes. So how would this explanation sound different when you're talking to a teen and, maybe the parents that are bringing them in with BPD?
This is a little more complex. So when you're talking to a teenager, first, it depends on where they're at. They're either going to be like, yep, I am the most emotional in my group. Or they're going to deny it and say, that's not me, or oh, this is everyone's over-exaggerating. So part of it is how much do they want to be in therapy? When you're teaching the biosocial theory to the family, you always, there's this kind of piece of the invalidating environment, quote-unquote, is in the room. So that means the parents, if they're the part of it, which all parents are invalidating, so they're part of it, you're talking to the teenager and the parent at the same time. So you're explaining why are emotions so hard for you to the teenager and saying, here's some, common examples that might be a little bit, a bit more than with your friends or something like that. And then when I talk to the parents, I'm also saying, it's pretty common to have, a teenager be overwhelmed with emotions when they're coming into my office, and here's why. So I try to actually sometimes disengage from the labels and just describe the behavior. Because sometimes they come in over-focused on diagnosis, and I really want it to be a behavioral thing. The goal is not to have BPD the rest of your life. The goal is to learn skills and manage it, and especially with teenagers, by the time they become adults, like, they just have really capable skills to manage emotions. Parents are interesting because they either are embarrassed, like, oh my gosh, you're saying it's my fault. Some of them come in and say, what'd we do? The other kids are fine, but this one, oh, we must have really screwed something up, so, which is really cute. And, of course, I say, no, you did not. Every relationship's different. Every kid has different presentation, and how you parent each kid is different, and, you know, that kind of thing. But I have to navigate who's the fault, you know, throwing, or who's the blame sometimes. You have to navigate telling the parent how they've been invalidating, or, you know, kind of encouraging examples without pointing fingers. Because there is this piece of, if they didn't invalidate, they're almost like not parents, while also knowing if it's too much invalidation or a lot of invalidation about certain things, like, you know, having a lot of emotion, crying for a really long time, things like that, then that can be a disconnect. So it's tricky to navigate, but it can also be a lot of fun.
So do you have any tips for clinicians out there who might want to talk about this with their clients, and let's say they run into a situation where the blame game is in full force, and the teens are blaming the parents are blaming their kids? Any strategies that you could advise?
Usually I do whatever I can to neutralize it. So I might say, you know what? You're here. Let's just talk about why you're here. I normalize both sides. I said, you know, I, and this is where I'm, you know, my personality, I think, just comes out. I say, wouldn't it be great if it was completely your parents' fault? And then I would just have to work with them, and you could go home and watch TV.
Yeah.
Or with the teenagers, then, your parents, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. You know, so I might say something to kind of make, like, the parents thinking, oh, my God, what is she saying to my kid, as a way to then get it, you know, kind of some neutral, you know, to throw them off so they maybe come back to a place where they're a little more centered, and then talk about saying, look, I want everyone to take a step back and just listen to, you know, me explain this briefly, and I want to get your opinion. So I want your heads in the game here, and you know, kind of like saying behave yourself, you know, because, of course, they're emotional. They're in therapy. They're meeting a therapist. Who's this lady? So I really try to step back and do it in as, you know, normalized and as much as possible, and validate as much as possible the pain of being there. And also make it so it's like, parents, relax, your parents. It's not your fault that your child has more emotion and is struggling. We're here. This is where we're at, and this is what I can do for you, and this is what I can do for the teen. And I really navigate, pretty much I explain it the same, but I'm doing it with a mindfulness that the parents are sitting there.
Mm.
And I, you know, not that I blame with adults too, but I have to be really careful. So for clinicians, they have to really think, how do I not join with either party and join at the same time? Like, how do I get them in the door to listen and be saying and head nodding with me while also not fighting, knowing they might not agree with everything? So there's a lot of dancing that goes around that.
Yes. So another thing that's different is, I think you gave a lot of helpful insights for how to validate and join and not join and dance with the parents when talking about the development of what's leading them to bring their teen into treatment. But I'm wondering about the course of treatment, because we're talking about the role of parents being part of the invalidating environment. And one difference clearly in treating teens and adults with BPD is that the teens are still dependent on their parents for a shelter, for finances, things like that. So knowing that they're still in that environment, how does this factor into your treatment and how you do DBT differently with teens than adults?
Great question. And, of course, every family's different. So I can have, like, 10 different families in my head, and I might answer a little bit differently for each one. Something that's how do you align with the teenagers, say, my job is to help you cope with your family, and then working with a parent is, how do you be a parent with a kid who's been in and out of the hospital for a suicide attempt, is self-harming, mm-hmm. and help manage their fears? Because I worked with a lot of parents that they stop parenting because they're scared that if they do some kind of consequence or say no or something, that their kid's going to kill themselves or their kid's going to, you know, resort back to self-harm, and it's been 4 months. And so then new problems develop. Like, they start skipping school and they let them and things like that. So there is a, you know, how do you navigate? There's also this piece of when do you say what, how much do you say? And I this is probably the place where I'm always questioning myself. And do I tell the parents this? And I have to stop and go through my checklist. Why? Why would I do this? Is this something that if I didn't exist, they would know or not? And I'm constantly doing that. And this is where I think there's probably like 25 different agreements out of there of when to say what. So with parents, I'm really transparent of my relationship with the kid, their kid, and also how I can be of support and help them, and balancing, you know, balancing, yes, your family's involved in treatment and you're my client and I have to help your parents manage you and your behaviors while also you're my, you know, it's a challenge. I don't know if I totally nailed your question.
I think you did. Absolutely. And let's continue on. And I think we may come back to some of this as we go.
Okay.
So, kind of, another piece is, you know, we started talking about how sometimes, like, adults are choosing to show up at your door, whereas teens may feel forced, or it really may be their parents making treatment happen. And DBT is a treatment that's voluntary. So how do you deal with this difference? How does your work on commitment and motivation look different or the same in teens and adults?
Good question. I have adults usually showing up at my door because they want to. They've been through therapist after therapist, and they finally figured out DBT might be the right fit. So that's kind of easy. With teenagers, there's a pretty big piece of, you know, why would they want to be with me, and how can I sell them to think I can be an asset to them, that I can help them make their lives easier. And so there's a selling point, and there's also this piece of how do I win them over as being, I used to be the, you know, kind of a cool younger adult, and now I don't think I'm as cool anymore. So I have to, how do I act teenagery while also not acting too teenagery, because then they'll think I'm weird. So the good news is I'm pretty good at being sassy by nature. And I swear sometimes in common language, and sometimes I've offended people in trainings because I swear. Teenagers kind of, it makes them stop and look at me like, therapists aren't supposed to do that. What is she about?
It's coming back to the unexpected. You gave an example of that earlier, but it really seems like an important element of working with teens.
It is. How do I act different than those other adults for them to think I might be helpful? And you have to be conversational. You have to, you know, like, I actually write down all the teenagers. I'm like, all right, let's go through the friend list, and I write them down. Kind of like, I'm on your side here. I want to know you. I want to know your people, and that helps. But so I think there has to be a fun part. I just had a teenager sing to me. She goes, "You haven't heard me sing?" Oh, and she just started singing to me, and I'm thinking, I haven't had anyone sing in therapy before. But she, I'm like, wow, she feels comfortable enough to share this tiny little piece of her. And also sing to me.
So what about working with family members? And we talked a bunch about teenagers. What about your adult clients? Do you ever work with family members of adults diagnosed with BPD? What does that look like?
A little bit. On occasion, I might. So if I have an adult who lives at home and there's a real concern of suicide, I might have them come in to talk about how do you make the house safe, or, you know, like hiding pills or something, locking them up, things like that, what to watch for. I also, a lot of it's psychoeducation, giving them resources. In fact, I refer people to Family Connections quite a bit, and talk about getting a therapist to support them or something like that, and saying, you know, we all need support. When you have a child, adult, or kid, doesn't matter, you need support. So I might do that. But a lot of times it's saying, here's what's going on. It's not often. Where I see most parents coming in with adults is usually parents of younger people, so kids in college. I've had a parent drive, two parents drive 2 hours away to come see me and decide if I was, you know, a viable candidate to work with their daughter coming back to school after a suicide attempt. So they were interviewing me, and I guess I won them over. I'm still working with their daughter. So there's this piece of, in that case, they're really a little disconnected. There's some overlap because those young adults are financially supported and at the same time keeping the line of being adults. So it's not soft, and it really is case by case, very different from teenagers.
Well, I think you're also bringing up a good point that our title even has a bit of a false dichotomy, teens versus adults. There's the whole emerging adulthood phase where you may have people who are technically over 18 and may present and have similar needs and treatment like how you would address teenagers too.
Absolutely. And go ahead.
I was just going to say, when we talked a bit about adult clients, now with teenagers, when you are involving their parents or family members, what do you do and how does it look like throughout treatment?
Oh, this is the fun part. Because it's really navigating, and it all depends on the teenagers. I have some teenagers who are like, okay, my mom can come in, and others who are really like, you're not telling my mom, are you? So navigating that's important. One thing I do right in the beginning is orient and teach and explain how I'm different, which means I'm consistently saying things like, I'm transparent. If I am not transparent, I'm kind of colluding with you behind your kid's back, we're not going to get anything done. That also means I'm going to know things you don't, parents, and, you know, as I'm speaking to parents, and that can be uncomfortable. If you trust me, you need to, you know that there's going to be this kind of ebb and flow of me knowing things and not calling you up. And I'll say, if I know they self-harm, that doesn't mean you're going to get a phone call. My goal is to work with her or him to stop self-harming, and I need to have room to do that and also allow space for your daughter or son, your child to come talk to me. You know, it's kind of that piece of I'm not a detective and I'm not here to gather evidence for you. So I tend to naturally be pretty blunt, which wins a lot of teenagers over. So helping the parents see why, and also when the parents call and, you know, ask a bunch of questions or give me an update, I said, okay, thanks for calling me. I see your daughter in a couple hours. I'm going to bring it up with her and, you know, have a discussion. So they know that it's very transparent. They know I'm transparent. The teenager knows I'm not going to run back to the parent and tell them everything. And I actually say, do you want to run this by me in a hypothesis? Like, this is my friend to decide if you want to actually tell me something or not. Go ahead. I think that throws them off because they're trying to figure out, what do I say? I'm like, I can only tell them if I have to things I know. So decide if you want to tell me. So I do that with the parents. It's really helping them to truly understand my role. A lot of times they call for coaching, so coaching and DBT is being able to contact me outside of sessions. And some teenagers are into it, some aren't. Sometimes I'm like working really hard to get them to call. It's amazing how it's usually the parents want it and they want help. What do I do with this? Or she's cutting, I know it, she's not showing me. And so I'm giving them a little bit of advice while saying, like, I'm not your coach. So it's it's interesting navigating. I think the hardest part is always deciding what to say. And then if I am having the parents come in, I want the kid to know why. So I said, look, I'm going to meet with your parents. I need to help them, you know, disconnect how they are viewing you as someone who self-harms instead of you are their kid. And I want that to be different. And I want them to, you know, get back to I'm a parent hat as opposed to I'm somebody who has a kid who self-harms in their house hat. And So I hope, you know, so I kind of, you know, it just really is different for every family. But transparency is, to me, the number one thing. Even
well,
though
this issue, this issue of transparency is coming up at a lot of different levels. And,
yep.
you know, this brings up the question and the issue of communication and communicating in ways that are accurate and direct. And
mm-hmm.
we know that for people diagnosed with BPD, often there are problems with interpersonal relationships. And one thing that can get in the way and interfere with interpersonal relationships is problems with honesty. So this could be in real life relationships and also in relationships with the therapist.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering what kinds of things you do and what kind of direct applications you can speak to us about for encouraging honesty. And again, as you answer, we want to kind of hear more about what's the same and what's different.
Absolutely. With adults, if I don't like to use the word lying. I might say withholding the full story or withholding pieces of the truth or something like that. And most of the time with adults, they're afraid of how I'm going to react. Well, I think I've had one recently said, so when, you know, if I tell you this, what will you think? Or, you know, like they're testing the waters. Like, will you think I'm going into, I've had someone say, will you think I'm crazy if? And of course, my answer is no. But there's a lot of shame in terms of sharing with adults for whatever, you know, for various reasons. What happened to them when they were younger, behaviors they did that they're embarrassed about. And just making the room to say, bring it on, I can handle it. And you know, sometimes
how do you do that?
How
do you make that room to respond when shame is interfering?
Yeah. So a statement I often make is say, look, I've heard it all, and you could, you know, I'm sure there's a few things I haven't. Whatever you put on my plate, I'm with it with you. I'm sitting with it with you. I'm not judging it. I'm not doing anything except holding it in the room with you. And I also give them room saying, if you're not ready to tell me, it's okay.
Yeah.
You decide. So, which is true, but it also takes the pressure off and say, let me know when you're ready. I'm here. And of course I am, because I'll see them the next week and the next week. Teenagers, they're interesting because they're always trying to figure out how far they can go without getting their parents called. What are things that are, you know, things that are just, they can't tell, what can they tell? And it is really interesting because that can range from someone who's like, oh, I know you can't tell, so by the way, my boyfriend and I, blah, blah, blah. Then, you know, but part of it's like usually like, so when do you tell my parents what? So that's a lot. And then also, if they're giving me a different version, I'm like, that's interesting. I told you your mom called. She said this. I'm like, what? Tell me your version. What's going on? So I don't ever look like I'm siding with the parents, but I also think, well, why the heck would she say that then? That's weird. So I challenge it in a off way. And then sometimes I just call them out and said, oh, come on, bullshit. Sorry, was I not allowed to say that?
Charlie does it on his podcast all the time, so I think we're okay.
So sometimes I call them on it, and I use their language, and in this case, it was a BS. And usually they start to laugh, and they're like, yeah, they know. So it depends. A lot of them, I say, test it out. Put out like a topic, and I'll tell you what I normally do with it, and you can decide what you tell me. So with teenagers, I think it just makes them more comfortable that I'm letting them know what I'll do in advance so they won't be surprised.
So we're talking about honesty, and
mm-hmm.
in terms of, you know, lies or dishonesty, there's two types. There's the lies of commission and lies of omission. You've been giving
mm-hmm.
us some good examples of I think in the general world, what would be called lies of omission, leaving things out. And you
mm-hmm.
and you gave us examples where often with adults, it's fear or shame that gets in the way. And you talked
mm-hmm.
about how validating, accepting, and being there is how you respond. But this is also true with teens, and it may be the issue of tattling or, you know, are you going to tell my parents? And you talked about that.
Yep.
What about the other kind of lie, the lie of commission, somebody telling you something that isn't true? How do you respond to that when you're working with people diagnosed with BPD, and how does that look different?
It's well, if the adults, this will be embarrassing, but it's true. A couple of the times that I missed it, where they were telling me that they hadn't used, and then I find out later they had actually used the fourth session, and I didn't know.
You're talking about using substances?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So then, so they're like, no, I'm not. No, I haven't used, or, you know, they got no zeros on their diary card. And then, you know, and if I say, wow, it's been this long, I'm like, you know, nothing, like kind of like challenging them in a kind of like, really, am I missing something? And then some of them come in weeks later and said, I've been lying to you. And then they tell me they've been using. And the embarrassing part is sometimes they had been using and I couldn't tell. So that's one. With teenagers, it's more of, you know, either they want me to think differently of them, like, are they cool or not? Or are they as, you know, I don't want to say ill, but are they, how mentally well they are or not? So I've had people make up symptoms that I'm like, this doesn't sound right. And I've even called a psychiatrist saying, are you worried about this? And it really comes down to, you know, why are they doing this? Is this, they're trying to decide if they want to be a healthy person or not healthy person. Are they trying to get someone in trouble? Are they trying to be more interesting than they think they are? Usually, you know, the end goal for me is always to say, you know, to keep my judgment hat off and always be curious on what's that about. But most of the time it's, and most recently it's kind of me trying to figure out with my most recent teenager, why that just doesn't seem right. And it seems like there's this piece of her struggling with being mentally well or mentally ill. In fact, you know, I just kind of named it and I said, I feel like you don't know what you want. And you're either the person who goes into hospitals, or you're a person who has after school activities and you're trying to like navigate this. And I got that one right. She said, you're the only one who ever noticed that. So I must have done well there. But, you know, I think in the end, it's why. And there's a reason for our full truth, half truth, and no truth.
And the why really emphasizes curiosity. For all
exactly.
of us as humans, being lied to can... it's totally natural to feel hurt or even angry when we feel like somebody we're in a relationship lies. And I like this idea of, instead of letting that anger or that hurtness kind of lead to judgments, you're talking about replacing that with curiosity.
Yes. And,
so,
and even people who are, sorry, I was just going to say, even when people have a really blatant lie where it's easy to get mad at, like, why would you ever make up that story? How does that help you in treatment? It doesn't. So stepping back and saying, gosh, that was an interesting one. Why? Where did that come from and why? And I think you're right. I mean, if you're really angry at your client, you're not going to get much done. And if you take off your, you know, judgment hat, it's like, oh, that's a new one. And why? And then you get more done. That's for sure. And your burnout stays low.
Both. It's grist for the mill and it helps you in the relationship.
Absolutely.
So also, let's switch gears a little. Actually, one more thing on this honesty piece. So you said that you don't really use the word lies. Did I hear that right?
Yes.
What do you use instead?
Good question. Some things I might say is, I feel like there's missing pieces here, or I'm curious on that. That just seems a little off to me. Can you explain it more? Or I say, I feel like that's not the whole story. So I try to not even say truth or lie if I can, only because that tends to lead someone to either be defensive or that. So I navigate that. And then there's also this internal philosophy where I always assume there's more that I don't know. I'll never know anyone fully, and it just kind of lets it go. Like, there's always going to be something I don't know. And I find out things about my clients so, like, 2 years later, I'm like, huh, that's a new one. Or teenagers come back as an adult, and suddenly the story's very different. Did they lie to me? Or was, you know, there a different story for protection? So I describe it as opposed to label it.
So you have a lot of strategies, both the therapy techniques, and it sounds like what you're doing as a real person to deal with this.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in your role as a therapist. The inaccurate communication or the lying is also an issue that comes up between teens and their parents. So all this stuff that you've been suggesting to us of how you would cope with it as a therapist, is this stuff that you think could be helpful for parents too, or would you suggest something different?
Well, there's this piece of, if you're a parent and you know, like, you know deep down in your wise mind, as we say in DBT, there's something off to this story, or your kid is trying to work really hard to get away with something. Like, parents are pretty good at having a little radar go off, and their radar's often on, maybe not always. Sometimes their kid might be innocent and really being honest to trying to get away with something or not. But I think part of it is to step back and say, why do I need to know the whole truth right now? If you're giving permission for them to leave the house, you want to make sure they're safe, of course. And at the same time, if you're really fixated on demanding the truth, does that really get you the truth, or does that get you a battle? So in some ways, I think for parents, you know, parents want to always know because that's how they feel less anxious. And, you know, the idea that their kid's doing something without them knowing or no, you know, they're supposed to be in that place. They're supposed to worry. There's also this piece of, yeah, I suspect there's a bunch of things that you're not going to ever know about your kid. You might find out when they're 40. And how do you tolerate the fact that there's missing pieces? So what are you going to do as a parent to ride that wave? Because you can't make anyone do anything. And parents, of course, don't like that because they are in the role of making their kids do something. So there is that piece of how do you help them walk that line, which will bring them a little bit of peace and take out some of the conflict. But it is also really scary, the idea that they might not know everything and their kids leaving the house for an overnight, for example.
Definitely. So going along this theme of communication, another issue with communication is how we communicate and, you know, these generational differences, right? That today's teens have all grown up with cell phones, texting, social media, tweeting, snapping, you name it. I'm curious about your thoughts on how social media and having one social network communicate through social media may actually contribute to problems that teens struggle with in treatment with you.
Well, first with them, it's often how they miss emotions with their friends. So there's this big argument by text, or I guess now it's Snapchat, and there's probably five more versions that I don't know. Usually they teach me the new ones. And most of the time they come up. And as they're reading the exchange, I'm thinking, like, I don't get it. Like, why is this a fight? Where's the fight behind it? Why is this person mad at you? And so a lot of times for teenagers, social media and, like, electronic communication, it throws off their interpretation of the world. It can also, you know, or maybe it's me not getting it as being an adult now. There's also this piece of they have a hard time communicating verbally. In fact, some of them, you know, if they have a conflict, they want to read their text to me of the conflict, or they say, just read it. And I don't. I say, you read it. But there is that piece of there actually is a disconnect sometimes in them being able to do pieces of therapy because you're asking them to do it without a phone. And so there's that piece. I think the interesting part, which I think is changing, but when a DBT was developed, it was phone only. In fact, landline only. There was no cell phones. And then when cell phones came along, it was like, oh, this is cool. You can contact me whenever. Or pagers went away and it's cell phones. And now it's, they can text you. And, you know, kind of traditionalists are like, you can never use text. And then there's this piece for us who treat teenagers like, well, if you're not going to ever let them text them, good luck ever getting them to contact you. So there's this piece of, okay, how do you navigate when to do therapy techniques like phone coaching? When is it text coaching? And when is it phone coaching? And how do you navigate? And also, how do you get to get teenagers comfortable talking on the phone is a whole nother ballgame too. So it's
and that's one thing that's different from teens and adults, both because of developmental differences and just cohort effects, right, of what people grew up with and what their experience has been like in living in the world with all the technology changes.
Those who just call me directly and leave a voicemail, you know, if a teenager does that, I'm, like, so proud of them. I'm like, oh, my God, they called me. Usually I get the text saying, can you talk now? Or I can't talk, but, and they put out their question by texting. So to get a teenager comfortable enough to talk on the phone is, like, a win for me. But adults, like, they don't want to text. They want to have a phone call, which works for me. But yes, that's a tricky piece of navigating that is helping someone communicate where it's safe and why, and when do you fluctuate and work with them in the way they communicate to make them comfortable.
Great. That's really helpful. So we got just a couple more minutes and I have a few random questions for you. You up for the challenge?
I'll bring it.
Okay. So let's say you have a time machine and you could deliver a message to teenage Jen from what you wisdom you've learned from doing DBT with teens. What would you tell yourself?
Okay, so not the adult me talking to my little kid teenager me, but from my work with them. Mine would be, gosh, it's interesting. Usually it's like, what would you tell your child self? In this case, I would.
And the difference is specifically from lessons you've learned from your clinical work with teenagers diagnosed with BPD.
Oh, that's so much easier. I would want to teach myself many skills I can do to bring my emotion dysregulation to make it less intense, and to also validate and help my teenage self know I will be okay if I don't get invited out on a Friday night. And, you know, if so-and-so doesn't want to be my friend, that is okay. And I actually would really want my, I really want them to know how to be stronger than I was, how to stand up for myself. How do you have confidence to go talk to a teacher, to go talk to that friend who's pushing me to do something I didn't want to? Because I think those are skills all teenagers struggle with. I kind of wish I had a therapist when I was younger. Probably would have helped me move along in my development more quickly. But I would probably want to take those certain key skills and plug them in to where my skill deficits were. I hope I nailed it.
You did. So tell us, we have a couple more minutes. Tell us a little bit about things you've learned from being a DBT therapist that you'd want to teach your teenage self, like maybe in a little more detail.
Things I learned as a DBT therapist in general. How to be comfortable in your own skin and how to just be you. I think one thing I love about being DBT is being a DBT specialist is it's not about being a therapist. It's about being you within a context of treatment. So I would want them to learn that. I would also want.
And that's something you've taught us on this call, Jen. That point I think you've illustrated in all of your answers and is really helpful for our clinical applications part of this series. So thank you for that.
Awesome. You're welcome.
We have time for one more question, so this is the last one. What's something you love about working with individuals diagnosed with BPD?
Oh, I wish we had a lot more time on that. I feel like they're so stigmatized, and people think of the worst person they ever met who also happens to have a diagnosis. And I'm the opposite. I will tell you, I love my clients with BPD. They're sitting with their emotion, their trueness. They're so genuine because they can't not be genuine in therapy. It's just they have too much emotion to block it. May they be disingenuous and hide themselves outside? Sure, maybe. The passion they have, the ability to notice things that others don't. I have a client who was the only one who noticed my haircut, except my husband, and he knew I had an appointment. Like, just to be that in tune to pick up on things, like, my gosh, I wish I was better at that than, like them. They're amazing, and I love their passion and their eagerness and their desire to find peace. And, I don't even know where to keep going, but, in the end, I love their emotion. I love
and
their emotion.
And for that, now let's look at your response to that question, and I'm going to ask you what's the same and what's different. So for how you responded to that question, is it the same for teens and adults, or are there parts that are different?
Good question. For I think with adults, there is definitely a trueness in a kind of a more like real developed stance. You're an adult sitting with an adult being a real person, and for the first time, sometimes for the client, for the first time, they're truly accepted. And they're really light. Like, I really like my clients. Lucky part about being in private practice. Teenagers, it's, to me, it's more of finding, like, this is a tough one with the teenagers. It's really finding, there's pieces of it, is finding how I like myself through them, but finding how you can really like how amazingly advanced they are intellectually, because they are way smarter than I was and am, and also how much they struggle. So seeing the dialectic of them trying to be as advanced as possible to get into college while also just struggling in ways and just, wanting so badly to figure that out and to live in life with happiness instead of pain. I love them because they finally have a safe place, and you can feel the difference having a teenager with that diagnosis being in the room with them and them being in a room with you, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. That was a beautiful response. Thanks for sharing that with us, Jen, and all of your other thoughts and expertise. So I want to thank you so much, Jen Eden, our speaker tonight, for donating your time and actually being the first person to jump into this new question and answer format. It's something we're looking into doing more with this series. And for the audience, thank you for joining us. Next week, we will be taking a break, so we will not have a live call in next week. And the following week, February 24th, we will be having a talk by Dr. Peter Fonagy on why is it so hard to learn to do things differently. Our host will be Dr. Emily Cooney. And this is going to be at a different time. It'll be at 2:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And if you're listening on the recording, be sure to check the archive version of this out, too, to those of you listening in the future. All right. Well, thank you so much, Jen. And everybody, hope you have a good night.
Thank you.
Perry, did you stop the recording?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I hope I did. I just closed down, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I closed down the website, but I it's hard to tell.
Well, then I'm a little nervous. I'm nervous because when you did it before, it said something when you stopped it. So I hope it was
right.
Recording.
It definitely was recording. I think if we hang up, we'll know that it'll end.
Okay, we'll hang up now.
And Jen, did a great job. Thank you.
Thank you.
Fabulous.
So much. Jen, that was outstanding. I'm really impressed how you could think so quickly on your feet with all those questions. You are amazing.
I
I rambled quite a bit, and then I'm thinking, boy, I hoped I answered the question because now I'm just talking. So hopefully
No, you did.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
All right. Have a good night. Thank you so much, both of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.